Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to David Ostrowski about his book, Pro Sports in 1993, a signature season in football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. This is David's second book. His first book is titled Game Over or Game On, How Pro Athletes Leave Sports and Enjoy the Game of Life. David, welcome to the show.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wonder if you could start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, you know, where you're from, what kind of work you do, where you went to school, those kind of things.
Yeah, sure. So I've lived in the Boston area my entire life. As I was talking to you before, I grew up in Newton, which is a suburb just outside of Boston. And then about a decade or so, I moved farther west, 8 miles out to Natick. I went to Brandeis and I did a lot of sports journalism there. Once I graduated, I was writing for several publications, including the AP Bureau in Boston, the Jewish Advocate, and the Metro West Daily News. Several years back, I published my first sports book, Game Over, Game On, and this was my second book, Pro Sports in 1993, and published by McFarland and Company, and it came out in November.
And I know you talk about this in the introduction, but for our listeners, can you just kind of explain what was special about 1993 in sports for you personally and just in general, what made it exciting year in sports?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And it's obviously one that's hard to answer in just one short statement. But I think for me personally, you know, Paul, I'm 36 years old. So in 93, I was nine. Growing up in Boston, I always tell people, you know, the teams were, it couldn't have been more different from what it was like today. The teams were pretty lousy for the most part. Patriots were really bad. Celtics were not very good. This was post Larry Bird. The Red Sox were at best mediocre, and then the Bruins were decent. So for me, I think as I was kind of becoming this massive sports fan, a lot of my strongest and fondest memories of that time did not involve Boston sports. You know, they were the Cowboys or Jordan's Bulls or, you know, the Blue Jays, Atlanta Braves, et cetera. So I think for me, you know, when I look back on my sports fandom career, if you will, I really think that year in particular had nothing to do with Boston, which I maybe partially explains why I'm such a big fan of all the different teams now in terms of following them, not necessarily rooting, but I never really felt that I was such a fan so tied to Boston sports per se, even though those are where my rooting interest lies. And then in terms of your other question, why it's such a pivotal year, I don't think it's just the personal thing. I really think, you know, when you look at the four major sports, it really was a monumental year. I think with baseball, when you look at what happened the year after, there was no World Series, there was no postseason. Of course, that was because of the strike. So 93 was the last year before there were major, you know, seismic changes in the game in terms of an expanded playoff bracket. And like I said, an entire season, which wouldn't be the case for a couple of years. In basketball, you know, you have what I consider to be probably the most eventful year in Michael Jordan's life. Not only does he have the three-peat, but he's loses his father, and then he goes and he leaves the game of basketball, and then goes on and tries baseball. So in terms of whom I consider the greatest player ever, I think that was probably one of, if not the most interesting years in his life. And of course, you know, when you look at the 90s and really just the late 20th century, you know, the Bulls dynasty is kind of like, you know, comes to mind as really being supreme then. And I really do believe, you know, that was when they were at the apex. And then in football, probably the most important franchise in the NFL, if not all of sports, is the Dallas Cowboys. And they were, they had this kind of renaissance then. And when you look at it in context, they have not been obviously nearly as relevant, let's say, since the mid-90s. And then lastly, in hockey, very simple, there has not been a Canadian team that's won the Cup since 93, which is fairly ironic when you consider that the sport was created in Canada. Half the teams are in Canada, and that's the country that's most in love with the sport. So very long answer. You know, that's why I thought this year, every sports year is important, special, whatever, but I really thought this year in particular was, you know, historic for some of those reasons.
Right. And I wonder about, so regarding the scope of the book, why, you know, I think of that year, I think of, I went to University of Michigan, so I'm a big, after that, but you know, that was a big year. The Fab Five, Chris Webber's timeout, all that. Why do you just decide to stick with the four major sports and just the four major professional sports?
That's a really good question. I was very much thinking about going into tennis. Of course, Tina Hingis, there was that terrible attack. And that was a major story. Monica Seles, excuse me.
Right. Shows you how much that was that tennis. That was that year? I was trying to...
Monica Seles.
Right.
You can probably tell I'm not a huge tennis fan. And that was happened in early May. She was attacked in Germany. And I was thinking very hard about writing about that, just because I thought it was a very important part of the year. And I think the aftermath of that was important, because what it did was it, you know, it really kind of changed the dynamic between fans and, you know, spectators and athletes. I ultimately didn't write about it because I really stuck with North America, with America and Canada, the four, you know, major sports. And I think McFarland, actually, they kind of advised me to stick with that too, just because, you know, it was such a broad topic in a sense, looking at one whole year of sports, that I felt like having it focused on just, again, the four major North American sports was good. And in terms of college, you know, I vaguely mentioned that incident with Chris Webber and the timeout and the Superdome and the Final Four, only because it was against Jordan, you know, Michael Jordan's alma mater, UNC, who went on to, you know, of course, win the championship that spring, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, I think, again, just to kind of have a sharper focus a little bit on just professional sports. But there were some certainly interesting stories in college. Charlie Ward at FSU was a big right. story then. But yeah, again, just I guess to have a little sharper focus.
Sure. So you start the book with this quarterback controversy in San Francisco. And I am old enough to remember this pretty well. Between Joe Montana and Steve Young. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny, being 9 years old in 93, my biggest memory or my only memories of Joe Montana were in the Kansas City Chiefs uniform. But of course, you know, it's like he won four Super Bowls with San Francisco. And I think what was so interesting was it was probably the biggest positional rivalry for quarterbacks ever, because, I mean, Steve Young's a Hall of Famer, right? And he was the successor to Montana. And a lot of times, like when it's a Jimmy Garoppolo taking the place of for Brady, you know, it's like the guy waiting in the wings is not, you know, a future Hall of Famer, right? And I mean, obviously, you know, with Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers, it's kind of more like the, you know, Montana Young comparison. But it's pretty rare that the guy succeeding a legend is going to be a legend himself. So I really felt like that was an important story that year. But I think the thing about it that I found the most interesting was the fact that basically Montana didn't play at all in 91 or 92. he suffered some devastating injuries at the end of the 1990 NFC Championship game, courtesy of Leonard Marshall, when the 49ers were playing the Giants. So he didn't play at all for 2 years. And he was 37, so, you know, not ancient. Still had a little time left compared to Brady, who's obviously very, very young. So I guess I found that interesting, just, again, the fact that he was on for 2 years, which is a long, long time. And part of that was because I think in 92, in the early fall, by around October, he would have been able to come back. But Young was having an MVP caliber season and did wind up winning the MVP. So I think, you know, again, the fact that he was gone for 2 years, and also the fact that they, it was not a bitter rivalry. I mean, they liked each other. They were fairly close. And yeah, I don't know. I just thought that, again, the fact that Young emerged, you know, it was, Young got drafted in the mid 80s. He was in the CFL, excuse me, in the USFL for a little bit. So it's like he waited, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. So I just thought that dynamic was very interesting.
Yeah. And I love the, you know, how you talk about in the book, how, as you just noted, Steve Young won MVP, and yet the 49ers fans were still pining for Montana, which was just fascinating. I was trying to think of an analogous situation, and the Favre Rodgers thing, of course, but as you said, the injury made it so unique. You know, I thought maybe, you know, when I thought of when Peyton left Indianapolis, you know, he had been out that whole year with his neck injury, and they were going to draft Andrew Luck, who was considered a can't miss guy. But of course, Luck and Peyton never played together like Young and Montana did. And so, yeah, that was fascinating. And then, of course, Montana led the Chiefs to the AFC Championship that year. He went on to the Chiefs, and he led them to the championship game, and they lost to the Bills. But really the most exciting game of that playoff, certainly on the AFC side and really on any side, was the Bills Oilers and that tremendous comeback. Can you talk about that game a little bit?
Yeah, this was the divisional round. So this was at the old Astrodome. It was a Sunday night MLK weekend. So I think a lot of people were tuned in because most people didn't have work or school the next day. And yeah, I mean, the Chiefs were down late in the game by, I want to say, around 10 points. And they came back. And, you know, this was big because they had just beaten the Steelers the prior weekend against Bill Cowher, Bill Cowher coach team. And Cowher was kind of like the understudy to Marty Schottenheimer, who was the Chiefs coach in 93. And, of course, he just actually passed away. But, you know, this game against Houston was it was a big win for them. Warren Moon was the quarterback for Houston. He had another stellar season. I mean, they were pretty big underdogs going in. I want to say it was a touchdown or even maybe 10 points, which is pretty significant in a playoff game. And yeah, Montana had another classic comeback. I guess, you know, that was kind of the story at the end of the day. Marcus Allen had the game-winning touchdown to seal it. And I just think there was a lot of talk before the game out of Houston that they were really going to lay a bruising on Montana. And he got beat up pretty good in the first half. But then in the second half, you know, in his kind of classic style, he came back. And I guess it was probably, in hindsight, the last highlight of his career. You know, and I say that because in 93, the final game he played was the next week in Buffalo. And it did not go well for him. He, you know, he got sidelined early in the second half with a concussion. He didn't play again. And then in 94, he did come back, and they went 9-7, but I believe they lost in the wild card round to Miami. So I guess in hindsight, it was probably the last hurrah. He was on the cover of SI that week after the Houston game. It was, I would say, the last major highlight of his career.
And then you have, of course, the Bills went on. The Bills went on to play in the Super Bowl that year, and they lost to the Cowboys. It was the third of four years in a row that they lost. And that Cowboys team was just, they were stacked. And it was really, I think of that team, that was kind of the last super team before like free agency really changed the NFL. And of course, that team was assembled in large part by the legendary Herschel Walker trade. So for those who are too young to recall, can you explain what went down with the Herschel Walker trade?
Yeah, I'll kind of give you kind of like the skinny on it. I'll try it. It was pretty complex. So in 1989, Jimmy Johnson's rookie year coaching the Cowboys, Cowboys are atrocious. They end up going 1-15. They're really bad. He comes over, right? He's been coaching at Oklahoma State and Miami and had a lot of success. It does not go well in Dallas. This is before they got Emmitt Smith, which we'll get to in a second. But, you know, they have a rookie quarterback, Troy Aikman, and they're not very good. So they're 0-4, and it's early October. And really, their only established offensive star is Herschel Walker, former Georgia standout. And he trades him. And he trades him to the Minnesota Vikings, who believe they're one player away from winning a Super Bowl. And that obviously didn't work out. But in a nutshell, what happens is he trades him for a bunch of draft picks and then players whom he cuts because there are conditional draft picks associated with those players. So long and short of it is because of Herschel Walker's trade, they're able to draft, you know, Emmitt Smith, Darren Woodson, Russell Maryland, some other players too down the line. Kevin Smith, I believe, a cornerback. And it turns out in a pretty short amount of time, as in like 2 years from then, they're a legit Super Bowl contender. And then, of course, in 92, they have this phenomenal year. They go 13-3, and they romp the Bills in the Super Bowl. And then the next year, they go back-to-back. But the cornerstone for that, those mid to early to mid-90s Cowboys teams, was trading Herschel Walker. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it. And today, this happens all the time in baseball when a team is out of it by, you know, early, mid-July, whatever, and the deadline's coming up and they trade their star player and they get in back, you know, a whole return, right, of minor league prospects. But back then in the NFL, this was just not something that people did, you know, that coaches, general managers had the foresight of doing, because he was literally their, you know, their franchise player.
Right.
I mean, it was a bold move. You know, they were a terrible team and they became even worse, you know, trading him. They had a running back named Darrell Clack who took over. And in the next year, they improved a little bit. And then it was in 2 years that they went 11-5. And then eventually, like I said, won the two Super Bowls.
Right. And one of the fascinating dynamics, which you discuss in the book with those Cowboys teams, was the relationship between Jerry Jones and Jimmy Johnson. What was that like? What was that relationship like?
Well, it's really interesting because they played together at the University of Arkansas when they were, you know, college football teammates, right, back in the 60s. And they roomed together, but that was only because their last names were so close. They weren't all that friendly. I shouldn't say that. They weren't close friends. You know, I think they were friendly. They knew each other or whatever. Obviously, they got along fine. But then, yeah, I mean, Jerry Jones, you know, makes a whole fortune in the oil industry. And I think Jimmy Johnson wants this new challenge after having led Miami to a national championship in 1987. And then on top of that, it was kind of time for Tom Landry, the legendary and only Cowboys coach ever, to step down. He had lost his fastball a little bit. And, you know, he gets let go and then Johnson comes in. And, you know, as I kind of point out in the book, some of the players really didn't think he had the right persona for the NFL. They thought he was a great college coach, didn't necessarily buy into what he could do in the NFL. I mean, he was a hard coach. I mean, he was not the easiest guy to play for. And yeah, in terms of the relationship, I think he eventually thought that Jerry, you know, was kind of, as is often the case for NFL owners, was a little meddling. You know, he would kind of come down to the sidelines a lot. He would come into the locker room and bring, you know, whatever celebrities he had with him, whether it was a prince from Saudi Arabia or, you know, who knows. And I think Jerry thought that, you know, Jimmy kind of was dismissive and didn't really appreciate the opportunity he had. And, you know, it's like crazy, but like after the 93 season, after their back-to-back Super Bowls, you know, they part ways and it's like, it makes no sense because Jimmy Johnson is still a middle-aged man. He hasn't been coaching in the NFL that long. And like, you know, because they had this clash of egos, you know, who knows how many Super Bowls they could have won. The Cowboys do win one 2 years later under Barry Switzer, but that's of course it.
Right. All right, we'll switch gears a little bit, move on to baseball. I told you before we came on the air here that I loved the detail you went into Camden Yards, because frankly, I'd forgotten what a big deal it was, and it really brought me back to that time in my life. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about, so the way you work it in, the All-Star game is played in Camden Yards in 1993. and was a huge event because Camden Yards had become this, you know, a big deal. And well, I'll leave that up to you. Can you talk a little bit about Camden Yards and its significance at the time?
Yeah, no, I think this was actually, Paul, one of the probably the chapter I was most excited writing about. I'm just as a massive baseball fan. And to be clear, the Camden Yards not open in 93. It did open in 92. That was the first year, but the All-Star game was in 93. So this was for MLB Network. I mean, yes, ESPN was around, but there weren't many highlights. There weren't games streaming all the time. So for many fans, the night of July 13th, 93, this was the first time they got to lay eyes on this ballpark. So why was it important? I mean, for those who are older than, you know, 35 and older, remember that in the 80s and the early 90s, the ballparks in many National League cities and even in some American League cities were not impressive at all. You know, in San Diego, San Francisco, and Pittsburgh, they were just dull. They had no imagination. They were multi-purpose facilities that housed football teams, rock concerts, speeches from politicians. I mean, baseball was just one activity of many there. And it was really insulting to the game, you know, when you think about it. And then I think in the late 80s, Baltimore had a ballpark that was north of the city, Memorial Stadium, that the Baltimore Colts had used to play in when they were the Baltimore Colts. And again, it was drab. It was uniform dimensions, just not very exciting, right? So anyway, in the late 80s, Larry Lucchino, who was president of the Baltimore Orioles, and HOK Sports, which was the organization used to design the ballpark, you know, they had this idea of a retro-style field, and it was kind of a throwback. It was meant to be a throwback to the old ballparks, like in Ebbets Field or Polo Grounds, you know, where you don't have uniform three things, I guess. You don't have uniform dimensions. It's located in the city, which is a huge, huge, huge thing. And then it's only for baseball. And anyways, it opened in 92. And, you know, I think there was a lot of hesitation. You know, people are like, why do you need to do this in Baltimore? You know, why do you want to have a warehouse? You know, like why do you need this? You know, like you already have a ballpark. And I don't know. I guess it was such a big deal because I think for what came after it, where you've literally had probably over 20 teams have ballparks in the downtown area of their respective cities and facilities that are only for baseball. And again, like I said, have some character to them. So gone is like the Metrodome in you know, Minnesota, which was really had like zero character, right? It was this like big indoor bubble. And it's important. I mean, it's not just important for the fans, but for the players too. And even for just the audience watching the game on television. And yeah, I mean, I just can't stress enough how maybe, you know, now people take Camden Yards for granted. The attendance has been dreadful over the past decade there, okay? The team is not, for the exception of maybe a couple years back in 2012, 2013, the team has been pretty lousy. So they have awful, awful attendance figures. But in the early to mid-90s, when it opened, it was like this, you know, eighth wonder of the world, right? And yeah, I just think now, you know, ballparks in San Diego, San Francisco, Minnesota, Pittsburgh, those are kind of the ballparks you think of when they're like, oh, wow, all these, you know, cool features and, you know, they're modern, whatever. Baltimore was the first one. And compared to what it was coming from, that's what made it so revolutionary.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. As I told you before, it really, you know, my father and I took a road trip to Baltimore. I was like, oh, you have to see Camden Yards. It was like the shiny new thing. And it was it was beautiful because it kind of captured the history of the game with the, you know, different dimensions, as you said, kind of based on Ebbets Field, but with modern features. And it was different. It was really different at the time.
And it was different.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, they've made adjustments to it also. Like when it opened up, there weren't all the features that have unique. There wasn't brick behind home plate. Now there is brick. You know, there was just padding. I mean, they've done things to spruce it up and also even make it a little more, you know, different, right, from some of the other, you know, prototypical ballparks that were around earlier. Right. And now you get very creative designs. But I think a lot of ballparks have adopted features based on Camden Yards.
Yeah. The other thing that really brought me back from that All-Star weekend was Ken Griffey Jr.
Yeah.
And again, one of those things that I don't know that people who didn't live through it can really understand what a big deal Ken Griffey Jr. was. I mean, he was the guy, and even, you know, beyond baseball, I think baseball was bigger in the national consciousness than in general in the sports world. And he was just, he was the guy. And I remember he hit that home run in the home run contest, and, you know, no one remembers that he didn't win the home. I was surprised when I read your book that he didn't win the home run derby, because that's all you remember from that home run contest. That's certainly all anybody was talking about the next day at, you know, was Griffey's shot. So for those that weren't, you know, around at that time, what was Griffey like? What was the aura around Ken Griffey Jr.?
I think, you know, for young millennials, it's hard to understand just how impactful he was in the game, because his career, let's be honest, was very front loaded, right? The first half of the career was in Seattle, where he put up his Hall of Fame numbers. And then the second half was in Cincinnati, where he was injured. And just quite frankly, you know, it was a big letdown compared to the years in Seattle. But yeah, I mean, for sports fans, you know, growing up in the 90s, I mean, he was, for all intents and purposes, the Michael Jordan of baseball, I guess you could say. Didn't win the championships, but in terms of, you know, the commercial endorsements with Nintendo and, you know, and I can't even remember the line of footwear, but, you know, yeah, I mean, he was the guy. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really hurting the sport today is there just aren't these recognizable stars like a Ken Griffey Jr. or even a Barry Bonds or Mike Piazza, Frank Thomas, what have you, you know, and that really does hurt the game. But yeah, he, you know, he was cool. He was hip. He wore his hat backwards. And this particular, you know, he had the ubiquitous smile, and he was just,
And the most beautiful swing you've ever seen.
You know, that combination of speed and power is so rare. And I truly believe, had he not gotten injured in the early 2000s in Cincinnati, he might be in, not only in the conversation, but almost like hands down the greatest player ever. I mean, I think you're talking about, you know, a guy who hits 800 home runs or more, you know, and wins the Gold Gloves and more All-Star games. But, you know, obviously it didn't work out just because of the injuries. But, and of course, there were never really any accusations, you know, of performance-enhancing drugs surrounding him, which was not true for many of the stars in the 90s. So, you know, all in all, when you look at the hindsight, you know, he really was this larger-than-life figure. And yeah, that day in Baltimore, he did something that's never been done before, which is on Utah Street, which is behind, you know, the warehouse in right field. There's this kind of, I don't know what you call it, pavilion, I guess, where fans hang out. And he hit the warehouse. And because of the aerodynamics, even with like a guy like a Chris Davis playing in Baltimore for all those years, it's never been done. You know, dozens of balls have plopped down in the street. But, you know, the fact that he nailed the pillar there was unprecedented and has never, like I said, done before. So yeah, it was just, again, like a really cool day for baseball, I guess is how I describe it. And then, you know, you put it in context, the prior year, you had, I mean, first of all, the players in the 94 All-Star game were threatening to boycott the game because they were so upset with ownership. And there was talk, you know, everyone knew the work stoppage was inevitable. So it was really not a very festive atmosphere at the 94 game, which was far from the case, you know, obviously in 93.
Yeah, I'll just add an anecdote for your book. I hope, spoiler alert, but you talk about in the book how Ken Griffey, how Michael Jordan goes up to Ken Griffey Jr. and asks him for his autograph. I mean, that just kind of shows what a big deal he was and the cool factor. And something something else you raised just now about the strike the next year, you know, it strikes me as we're talking about this right now, one of the special things about the 93 baseball season was it was kind of the end of the innocence of baseball in a way. You know, it was so much changed after that. And Camden Yards represented that, and Ken Griffey Jr. represented that, you know. And then of course, the next year was the strike. And then you had the whole PED scandal, and Ken Griffey Jr. broke down. And the sport really hasn't been viewed the same way since that 93 season.
I mean, I think Mike Trout, you can make an argument that he's just as talented, if not more so than Griffey, but I mean, he just doesn't have he seems like a wonderful guy, but you know, the charisma, right. Is, you know, the endorsements, the cool factor that Griffey has, you know? And again, I mean, he's a ball player and, you know, that's not his job, but Griffey did was a showman, you know, in that sense.
And one other guy I want to bring up, who I'm so glad you included in the book, and this is a Yankee fan of me coming out as well, but Jim Abbott is a guy who also went to University of Michigan, my alma mater. Jim Abbott is a guy who I feel has been kind of lost to history and, you know, is one of the great, I think one of the great heroes of our lifetimes in sports. I mean, he is such a wonderful example for people of all ages and disabilities and everything. And so can you talk a little bit about Jim Abbott and of course his special day that year?
And he, you know, pitched with his left hand, and it was kind of hard to explain, you know, on a podcast, but the maneuver he had with his glove and how he was able to, you know, switch hands was pretty incredible. And he had been a solid starter for a number of years for the California Angels, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. And he was pitching in New York now. And the Yankees were having a so-so season. They were kind of treading water, you know, a little bit above 500 in the race with Toronto. And anyway, on Labor Day weekend, he pitched the no-hitter. And, you know, the chapter is really the focus is on the Blue Jays and, you know, them winning a back-to-back title and Joe Carter and so on and so forth. But I thought it was really interesting that in that particular month of September, Jim Abbott, you know, threw a no-hitter. And then 2 weeks later, Curtis Pride, who was born legally deaf, made his major league debut in Montreal. So I just thought for, again, you know, for those with disabilities, it was a pretty inspiring month when you think about it. I mean, there were some other highlights in the month. Like, I mentioned Dave Winfield got 3,000 hits. You know, George Brett, Nolan Ryan, they're retiring. Mark Whitten, I think, had 13 RBIs in a game. Some interesting things and great pennant race in the NL West. But I really do, from my perspective anyway, that it was really interesting, you know, those two accomplishments.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, of course, the Blue Jays won that World Series to win back-to-back championships, and that they had a stacked lineup that year. And that Phillies team that they played in the series was had a lot of fun personalities. So that was exciting. But in the interest of time, we're going to move on to basketball. Oh boy, man, this is tough. As you know, I'm a Knicks fan, and that 93 Eastern Conference Finals was brutal. Man, so of course that was the Bulls' first three-peat, the first of two three-peats. And what were some of the obstacles that they had to overcome as a team to complete that three-peat that year?
So it's kind of funny just because, like, you know, this was my first year really following, you know, the NBA, and I thought it was so exciting, you know, and everything. But I watched like some documentaries on it for the Bulls, when they were doing interviews, looking back, it was like, oh, this again, like another run through the, you know, NBA, the grind of the NBA season. Cause they had just won two titles, right, against, you know, the Lakers and then the Trailblazers. And it really was a grind this season. They won 57 games, no small accomplishment, but I mean, they coasted in the regular season. They were not playing balls to the wall in the regular season. You know, Jordan and Pippen had just come off the, you know, dream team experience in 92, you know, right in the heels of winning against Portland. So they really didn't have much of an off season. And of course, you know, they were the team, right, for all intents and purposes. So it was a grind. And I mean, I think in this series in particular was very fascinating for no other reason, just that, you know, Jordan's gambling activities came to light, right? For, you know, just to give a little quick summary, before game two of the Eastern Conference Finals played at Madison Square Garden, it was learned that Jordan had spent the night before in Atlantic City, you know, the casinos, Grand Valley Resort. And, you know, he was reportedly there as late as 11:30. Some people swore he was there even after that. So you do the math, and he just basically got a short little nap before the morning shoot-around. And then, you know, it was compounded by the fact that he didn't play particularly well in game two. The Bulls lost them, you know. The Knicks went up 2-0, but I think it's just interesting because I think in today's society, this would not, I mean, first of all, like it would have been in real time, you know, there would have been social media would have lit up, you know, and I think also just there was a stigma around gambling back then in the early 90s, mid 90s, that's not around today. And I just don't think it would have been quite as big a deal just because, you know, it's like, ooh, you know, going to a casino, you know, it's like, it's just not something that people really, you know, make into a whole, you know, front page news. But back then it was. Gambling was not legal outside of Las Vegas, you know, Nevada. So, yeah, it was a huge story. And, you know, the Bulls came back, and as you don't need me to tell you, you know, they won four straight games and went on to beat the Suns in the NBA Finals. But, yeah, I think that series in particular was a grind just because the players, you know, came to Jordan's defense. I mean, they were really annoyed at the media for, you know, especially the tabloids, the Post, the Daily News in New York, for, you know, prying into their personal lives. And yeah, I mean, it was a huge distraction, and but obviously not that much of a distraction in the sense that the Bulls won the next four games.
Yeah, in retrospect, it's one of those things where it was a huge story at the time, and it was completely meaningless. It meant nothing. Like, it was that the amount of attention it got for what it really was ridiculous.
I mean, he took a limo with his dad and a couple of friends. He didn't drink and drive. He wasn't, it was legal in Atlantic City. You know, he wasn't doing anything illegal. I mean, he was, you know, he could, this was Michael Jordan. So it's not like he could go out to a club in New York City, right? You know, I mean, or, you know, go to a restaurant or whatever. He would get mobbed and, you know, he just wanted to get away. And, you know, whether you like him or dislike him or fall in between, it probably wasn't the end of the world that he was doing this.
Yeah. And so, of course, that was the conference finals. And then they met the Suns, Charles Barkley and the Suns in the finals. And Charles was the MVP that year, and he was playing at just a phenomenal level. You talk in the book a little about how Michael kind of softened Charles up, how he befriended him to soften him up. And that's something that, you know, a few years later, Jeff Van Gundy accused Jordan of doing, that he did it to people on the Knicks and people around the league in general. Do you think that was really Michael's intention? I mean, do you think he and Charles were friends? Do you think he was just using Charles? What do you think was going on with Michael with that?
I think they were friends. I think, you know, I think obviously from the Dream Team experience, which Barkley was on, you know, they got pretty close. And yeah, I think there was a little bit of manipulation there. You know, he supposedly went golfing with Barkley. He bought him some nice jewelry that week. And, you know, the idea was that if Barkley was charging through the lane, you know, he would kind of take it easy on him or, you know, whatever. And I don't know. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, Jordan was just better than Barkley. And it's like, you know, in 91, the marquee matchup was him and Magic Johnson, but Magic was at the very, very end of his career. And the next year it was Clyde Drexler, who was just, let's be honest, not at the level of Jordan. So, yeah, I mean, I think this was really the first time he had a formidable opponent in the NBA Finals. Because as you mentioned, Barkley was MVP. He was probably the second best player in the world at that point because, you know, Bird and Magic were pretty much on the cloud. Bird was retired and Magic had retired for the first time. And so I think these were the two best players. So, yeah, I think there was a little bit. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think just Jordan was so much more dominant, you know, than any team or any player in the league that I think it was just inevitable he was going to win a title that year.
Yeah. And then of course, after that season, in October of that year, I guess Michael shocks the world and retires from basketball. And then a few months later, he announces that he's playing minor league baseball. And the big, you know, obviously the big sad event in between is his father died and, in really horrific fashion. Do you think Michael walks away from basketball if his father didn't die?
It's a great question. I don't think so. I think the baseball thing, you know, as I kind of point out in the book, was, you know, an homage to his father because his father's favorite sport was, in fact, baseball. You know, I think the pressure, you know, just being probably one of the two or three most famous people in the world was building on him. And baseball, in a sense, was, I guess, kind of a break from that, especially playing in the minor leagues in Alabama. But I don't think so. I think, you know, that was obviously such a tremendous shock, that tragedy, that I think, you know, while he was exhausted and, you know, and like I said, hadn't really had much of an off season the year before, I think he probably would have kept playing basketball in the 93-94 season, had that not been, you know, such a traumatic summer.
Yeah.
But you never know. I mean,
no. And the fourth major sport, hockey.
Yeah.
I remember that year. I grew up on Long Island. I was an Islanders fan. I don't really follow hockey anymore, but I did then. And I lived about 15 minutes from Nassau Coliseum, and I used to go to a lot of games. And the Islanders faced the Penguins in the playoffs, and the Penguins were two-time defending champs, and the Islanders knocked them off on David Volek's goal in Game 7, and that was like euphoria at the time for a 16-year-old hockey fan. And of course, the last team standing was the Capitals, and it was fascinating to me. I'm sorry, the Canadiens. It was fascinating to me that discovering in your book that Jacques Demers was illiterate. I had no idea. And how was he able to coach a professional hockey team without reading and writing?
Jacques Demers was their coach, and he did grow up in a very dysfunctional household, as I point out in the book. His father was incredibly abusive, and both he and his wife did die at a young age. And so he, you know, Jacques Demers really never got much of an education. Like, I want to say he left school for good at like 13. So he was working all throughout high school, and then, you know, or what would have been high school in his college years. And I mean, it was very embarrassing, you know, as I kind of mentioned in the book, like, you know, he would, he'd have a piece of paper and, you know, a note or some, you know, kind of like play drawn up, and he couldn't read it. And he, you know, he'd pat his, he'd pretend to be like very, like have poor eyesight, right? And he'd pretend like his glasses weren't there. So, you know, I think it's something he didn't come out with until long after he left coaching. And he did confide in some assistants at the time. And I think some people in his inner circle knew, and certainly some of the players did, but he, credit to him, he kept it a big secret to the public. And I mean, it just was not easy, you know, like I think a lot of the communication obviously had to be verbal. And he had to kind of, you know, pretend and make up some excuses for when there was notes on paper and whatnot.
And what was it that made that Canadian team special?
Patrick Waugh. And for those who don't know or aren't big hockey fans, he was, you know, probably one of the top five goalies of all time. And just in short, I mean, that team won 10 straight postseason games. After losing their first postseason game, they won 10 in a row, which is, I mean, really, when you think about it, a pretty remarkable run, which means your goalie has to be perfect in 10 overtime sessions, which he was. I think it was like over, I don't even know how many minutes of hockey, but, you know, it's pretty impressive to not let up a goal in 10 straight overtime periods when you think about it. I mean, just in terms of the depth of the team, you know, they had a lot of depth. They didn't have the star power. You know, LA had Wayne Gretzky, whom they faced in the finals. But, you know, Patrick Waugh was really the backbone of that team for sure.
And as you note in the book, and as you mentioned, of course, that was the last Canadian team to win a Stanley Cup. And which is crazy. As I said, I don't really follow hockey anymore. And I was shocked to read that. Is there a reason for that beyond the obvious fact that there are many more teams in the United States than there are in Canada, and it's just, is it just chance, or is there a reason beyond that?
No, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's a couple things. I think, you know, in the past, what, 93 was 28 years ago, you know, you've had a lot of new teams, right, that have come into existence, have been transplanted to southern regions, so like the Dallas Stars, the Carolina Hurricanes, Tampa Bay Lightning, you know. And just the sheer number of expansion teams has made it more diluted, right, around the league. And I think a lot of it, like anything in hockey, is by chance. I mean, the Canadians have not had very good teams for the most part, you know, in the 21st century, nor have the Maple Leafs, for that matter. The Senators have not been very good. The Canucks, you know, they used to have Pavel Bure, have not been particularly good for the most part. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just a lot of it, again, the sheer number of teams. And I think in 93, the fact that the Canadians were playing the LA Kings in hindsight was pretty interesting, because the Kings were not this franchise that people were expecting, you know, to become a dynastic team, which they were in the early 21st century. And it was just kind of new, relatively new, speaking, having hockey, you know, in Southern California, you know, or south of the Mason-Dixon line. And obviously, that was just a preview of what was to come.
Yeah, the whole Kings thing, I mean, it was kind of like, it's Hollywood, and they got the big name in Gretzky, and it was like, you know, the fashionable thing to do. But of course, nobody thought of LA as a hockey town or as a hockey team.
Magic had retired and the Clippers right. were still not very good. That helped a lot too.
Right. That's right. Does it bother Canadians that a Canadian team hasn't won the Cup in so long? Is that something that matters to them?
I think so. I mean, I've been to Canada about 15 times in my life and just to go to Montreal, Toronto, whatever. And, you know, I mean, I can just give you one short anecdote. Like my wife and I were at a restaurant in Toronto in June and there was an electronic clock. It was literally counting down to the seconds until the Maple Leaf season, the puck would drop, you know, in coming October. So I think it does, you know, it's got to. I mean, most of the players on these teams, well, let me put it this way. Many more players on these teams we've mentioned in Dallas, Tampa, Carolina, Anaheim are Canadian than American, you know? So I think it's got to. I mean, and again, like now we're talking 28 years. So it's a fairly lengthy drought at this point.
Yeah. About the book on a whole, and again, for our listeners, this book is really exceptional. It's you could tell David's passion about all these sports comes through in the books, but they're also extremely informative and really shine a light on what was going on in the sports world in general in 1993 and why that was such a special year. So I definitely recommend this. I wonder, David, what was the hardest part about writing this book?
Well, I think for any book, you know, like this, securing interviews is always a challenge. But then on top of that, and you know this very well, getting non-cliche material from some of the interviewees was very challenging. And it was very hard, I think, you know, because you're talking to a lot of people about, you know, teammates that they really admired, whether it was a Gretzky, a Troy Aikman, a Joe Montana. So I think it was very hard. While people were willing to talk, it was pretty challenging to get personal or even, you know, anything kind of controversial. The other thing also is that, you know, a lot of these people I wrote about in events, certainly Michael Jordan, Ken Griffey Jr., you know, the Cowboys have been written about over and over again. So finding a new perspective, I think, was very interesting. And then lastly, the other challenge was there was so much material, right? Like, and I, you know, kind of estimate that I think probably 15 to 20% of all the information I got, I actually ended up using. Just because, like, there's so many, you know, you're talking about different teams and different cities and different leagues and everything, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles. And I think being able to, you know, reduce it down to material that I thought was actually interesting, you know, it was a pretty, you know, intensive process there, weeding things out.
Okay, I'll get you one last question, and I'll get you out of here. But first, let me just say again, the name of David's book is Pro Sports in 1993. A signature season in football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. My final question for you, David, is one I like to ask all of my guests. What is your all-time favorite sports book?
Oh, boy. The one that always comes to mind is Teammates by David Halberstam. As a lifelong Red Sox fan, that book naturally I kind of gravitated to because it goes into like the end-of-life story of Ted Williams, Johnny Pesky, Bobby Dorr, Don DiMaggio. So I guess it's kind of – I've, you know, obviously read hundreds and hundreds of sports books, but I think that's the one I would probably have to answer just, you know, right away. Although I will say Jeff Perlman's Boys Will Be Boys about the Dallas Cowboys was a really entertaining book and one that I used quite a bit for research. I mean, that's a really quick read if there ever was one. So I would say those two, but I lean towards Teammates by David Halberstam.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with Halberstam, right?
Right.
Yeah. All right, David. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the podcast. Again, as I said before, David's book is excellent. I highly recommend it. And good luck with everything, good book sales and everything else going forward.
Thank you very much, Paul. It was a pleasure to be on, and I really appreciate the opportunity.